And now we just do it.
How you doing today, Mr. Bromley?
Hey, Chris, I'm doing well, sir. How are you? The background is looking nice. Listeners, for those of you who have been listening and following along, we know that we've been cataloging Chris's move from one studio to another, and it's looking good, Chris, including the, I'm assuming that's a ladder because you're putting stuff up in the background.
That is a ladder, yeah. Slow and steady as she goes. Eventually, I hope to have like a mobile backdrop so you don't have to look at my messy workbench back there, but... Yeah, everything takes longer than you think.
We all want to see what you're working on, you and Claude, what you're getting done these days. You know, that's how I frame it to most folks I work with now. I'm like, what did you and Claude do over the weekend? And no one ever corrects me anymore.
But I got sign off today to do a little revitalization of an old project I did that was sort of you built what with Lima Charlie. So you will be seeing some content from me about detections in the garden. And nice. Watering responses, so we've got some ideas about how to play that out.
Yeah, folks, I would like to let all of our listeners know that, if you haven't played around with Lima Charlie, Chris is the case study of like all the cool things you can do outside of enterprise deployments. And it's an awesome thing because Chris will deploy Lima Charlie in various places, and then it's like as a telemetry reporting tool, it's super useful, number one. But then number two, you're like, wow. Didn't even think about that use case. And I'm going to give everyone a preview. We're not going to talk about it, but I'm going to give everyone a preview. I want you to Google Chris's name and satellites and just see what comes up. Because you guys have also done a lot of discussion around satellites and space objects as well. So I'm going to leave that nugget there.
Yeah, I could get the sign off for that. $100,000 to launch a CubeSat into space. I thought it would have been a great marketing project, but not in the budget this year. So.
This year. Notice the caveat there. This year.
And actually, I don't think it was even the budget that was that big a deal because like everybody really liked the idea. It was like, who's going to work on it? Because it's $100,000 and then probably a team of six for like 6 months, which is really the big cost, right? So,
you know, these humans getting in the way of being successful here.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of humans getting in the way of other people getting successful, let's get to it. Attackers have started actively exploiting CVE-2026-20230, a critical vulnerability affecting Cisco Unified Communication Manager, or CUSM, C-U-C-M, with attacks appearing less than 24 hours after SSD Secure Disclosure published a proof of concept and complete exploit chain. The flaw is an input validation vulnerability that allows an unauthorized attacker to perform server-side request forgery and escalate privileges to root. It affects Cisco Unified and Unified CMSME deployments where the web dialer service is enabled. Cisco, which released patches on June 3rd, advised organizations to treat the issue as critical despite its CVSS score of 8.6. Web dialer is disabled by default. CUCM is Cisco's platform for managing voice, video, and messaging services, with the company reporting roughly 30 million users worldwide. According to the article, SSRF vulnerabilities are particularly dangerous on communications platforms because they can expose internal management and application services. SSD Secure Disclosure demonstrated an attack chain that begins with a crafted HTTP request to the web dialer service, allowing access to internal services, including an Apache Access SOAP. Oh my goodness, what year is it? to an Apache Access SOAP service. Attackers can then write a malicious JSP file into a public Tomcat directory. I'm sorry. All these technologies are like going taking me back to the beginning of my career. Yeah. Into a public Tomcat directory, deploy a second JSP web shell, achieve remote code execution, and ultimately gain root privileges. Researchers at Diffused reported seeing attacks against their Decoy CUCM systems within a day of the POC's release. They had previously observed scanning activity identifying vulnerable systems before exploitation began. The attacks closely followed the publishing exploit chain abusing the web dialer SSRF flaw to deploy a rogue Apache access service, write a first stage JSP file, and install a second stage command execution shell. Diffused also noted that the password protecting the deployed web shell matched the one included in the public POC. The article says organizations running CUCM with web dialer enabled that have not patched should assume their systems have been scanned, Horizon 3.ai released a rapid response test to help organizations determine whether their environment's exploitable without causing damage. The company urged affected organizations to apply Cisco's mitigations immediately or disable WebDialer if it is not needed. The article also notes that this is the second urgent Cisco patching issue for organizations with large Cisco deployments this week, following attacks targeting a separate Cisco Catalyst SD-WAN vulnerability. So I find this one interesting because I think it's something that we've talked about in the past, and it's sort of the spawn camping with AI on these vulnerability disclosures. You know, patching is important, but like the time from when these things are disclosed publicly to when they can be weaponized is so quick that unless you're right on top of your patching, you're going to have these vulnerable moments where robots are going to come in and pwn you.
Yeah, Chris, I think there's another component here which needs to be considered, and you tapped into it as you were reading through the description, which is like, man, I mean, this is not hard to automate because there is a history of these things working here. And I don't mean to be, blunt about this one, but like if your vulnerability is exposing SOAP services and then subsequently leading to like JSP web shuttles and stuff like that, like I know, and I'm being a little bit facetious intentionally here, but I'm also trying to be very blunt about this here. Folks, these are the types of attack chains that they practice in college classes. Like this is not the type of novel thing where, okay, you know, clearly a researcher needed to have like inside knowledge on how to do this. And, you know, good thing someone was sitting in that exploit dev class because they needed this and that. Like this is pretty run of the mill, straightforward stuff. And I'm not trying to throw shade at any, you know, developer or programmer in particular here, but I am trying to call out like stuff like this is going to be easily and quickly and rapidly weaponized because it is such a straightforward attack flow. Like I would imagine there are scanners running 24/7 that are looking for, can I drop a web shell on this thing? Right. And that's kind of like the starting prompt, if you will, for lack of a better term. And there probably is some AI enablement there as well. But the starting prompt is, can I drop a web shell on this thing? And how can I go about dropping a web shell on this thing? And if your, you know, method or attack technique is one or two things chained together, it creates an opportunity for very easy automation. It creates an opportunity for very easy scale. It's not that complex of a topic to try to figure out. This idea of, hey, you can run a thing and you can arbitrarily upload files that you can then access. Like that's baked into like ScriptKitty 101 and, you know, Hacker Class 101 and stuff like that. And Chris, I just want to call out here that like what this does is you talked about patching schedules. Not only does it enforce the need for a very, very rapid turnaround patching schedule on, you know, vulnerabilities like this, but it also significantly cuts down the amount of time that it takes to weaponize it. But it's because of that, it's an inverse lever. It really expands just how bad things can get, in my opinion. And I'm not talking about this vulnerability, just this one in particular, but like the ease of being able to weaponize, the ease of deployment, the ease of exploitation, coupled with just how far you can go with it, is something I think organizations need to start baking into their vulnerability disclosure / like, do we care about this? Do we patch now decisions? And that's one of the things that you and I have talked about on the show quite a lot, has been like, patch, patch, patch. We say it somewhat casually as if it's easy to just, you know, oh, click, patched, all done, right? But vulnerability reporting and know-how and insight and risk assessments and do I need to take a thing down to patch that and so on and so forth is a decision that needs to be made with, like, I think a lot of urgency now because, as this article points out, your ability to sit and wait is gone. I mean, it's mm-hmm. for some vulnerabilities, it's gone. It's seconds, maybe single digit minutes at best before someone will find it and then you're on a list and then it's just rapid fire exploitation.
Yeah, definitely going to get interesting. And I think the next big innovation we'll see is a way to rapidly deploy patches in an automated way. I know there's a lot of danger involved in that in enterprise environments, but it's a problem that I think needs to be solved because this isn't going to go away. It's only going to get worse.
Yeah,
agreed, 100%. And just for people listening, I was working with JSP in SOAP back in like 2009. Back when I was using a thing called SVN to do code repository stuff before GitHub, before REST, like this is old technology, so it's kind of wild to see it still being used at that scale.
Yeah, and that's where I And it's, I don't want to date Chris and myself here, but I'm just saying, folks, if we are reciting an article's findings and we're both like, what year is it as we recite them? Trust me, it's been around for a bit. That's all I'm going to say.
Sacred texts. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Next up, the latest update to the Ransomware Tool Matrix, or RTM, and Ransomware Vulnerability Matrix, or RVM, adds a detailed profile for three ransomware groups, the Gentleman, Dragon Force, and Warlock. Rather than providing a broad overview of the ransomware landscape, the update focuses on helping defenders quickly access group-specific intelligence for threat hunting, detection engineering, and vulnerability prioritization. And I'll just give a shout-out to Zach Allen. This is one I pulled from his newsletter, the Detection Engineering Weekly. Always really great content. The author notes that each group represents a different segment of today's ransomware ecosystem and provides dedicated RTM and RVM profiles for each. First up, the Gentleman is described as a relatively new operation that has rapidly developed a broad toolkit illustrating how ransomware affiliate ecosystems increasingly share techniques and tooling. The group's profile incorporates insights from a recent internal chat leak documenting observed tools and exploited CVEs across multiple intrusions. Dragon Force has continued expanding through 2025 and into 2026 by targeting managed service providers and introducing a cartel model that allows other affiliates to participate. The group has been observed exploiting vulnerabilities affecting internet-facing products, including Avanti, Fortinet, SonicWall, and SimpleHelp. Warlock, meanwhile, gained attention following exploitation of the tool shell SharpPoint Zero Day and has also been linked to attacks targeting SmartMail, SolarWinds, Web Help Desk, and Gladinet Center Stack. The update highlights several trends observed across all three groups. Bring your own vulnerability driver, BYOVD. Techniques are now common rather than exceptional, with each group using vulnerable drivers to disable or evade endpoint detection and response products. The author also notes that internet-facing systems remain the primary entry point, with products such as Fortinet, Avanti, SonicWall, Microsoft SharePoint, SmarterMail, SolarWinds, Web Help Desk, Gladinet, CenterStack, and SimpleHelp appearing across the threat profiles. Prioritizing patches for externally exposed infrastructure and administrative tools continues to provide significant defensive value. The author also emphasizes the growing use of legitimate administrative and remote access tools during ransomware operations. Utilities including Velociraptor, Cloudflare, VS Code, Tunnels, AnyDesk, Mesh Central, FreeRDP, PuTTY, and OpenSSH, as well as various cloud services, are increasingly being repurposed by threat actors. The recommendation is for defenders to use the RTM and RVM profiles to hunt for these tools, develop behavioral detections, establish baselines for legitimate use, and block software that is unnecessarily within their environments. The post also points readers to community resources such as RuleHound, Detection.fy, and SnapAttack to help translate the published threat intelligence into practical detection content. So yeah, just a great source of information for folks who have ransomware is one of the things that keeps them up at night. Just kind of give you a little bit of insight into what the new and cool kids are up to on the dark side of things.
I mean, first off, hat tip to these graphic generations. I mean, wow, Warlock, Dragon Force, The Gentleman, Bushido Token. I'm not sure where we go from here, and no offense to anyone. You and I, Chris, we've actually looked at quite a few posts from this blog/website before, so there's some interesting stuff there as always. I know you and I have also expressed our thoughts around the common naming and renaming and different classifications of groups and everything like that. I mean, okay, I just find it interesting. I think the bigger takeaway and perhaps the thing I think more focused on here is, for folks who don't understand just what that community looks like, right? We are talking about criminal enterprises, organized like cartels, right? Affiliate-based groups, the types of operations that they engage in, how they kind of, you know, reach levels of phases of maturity and stuff like that, you know? Looking at Dragon Force, right? Branching into MSP-focused attacks. Like, please understand, folks, from an adversarial perspective, any target which gives a one-to-many relationship is always going to be a prime target. MSPs, MSSPs, things like that. You know, it's an old example now, but like SolarWinds is the perfect example, not of a ransomware attack, but of a one-to-many relationship. You compromise the vendor, and then you get the vendor's customer list to go after that. So there's a lot of things to pivot into and to look at here. I think The other really interesting side of this is just how quickly these groups move and kind of grow up, for lack of a better term. Maybe mature is the right word to have there. Looking at this grouping right here, you know, we're seeing the Gentleman is a newer operation. They've matured quickly, varied toolkit. There's an internal chat, which looks at how they work and whatnot, the CVEs that they target. Just a lot of really interesting information, I think, that for anyone who's doing this type of CTI work can be, you know, is very useful. But then also for defenders that are out there, like, please understand, it's a force to be reckoned with. I'm not one to cry wolf about ransomware groups because I know it plagues a lot of CISOs and budget meetings and stuff like that. But they are, unfortunately, a well-organized and kind of put together force that needs to be dealt with or needs to be handled correctly. And I can't say it other than, like, shore up your defenses because they know what they're doing.
Awesome. I realized we had the wrong copy for one of our articles here, so I'm just going to paste it in here and we'll go off the cuff.
Sounds good.
Yeah, this one looked interesting. We're talking about the Russians here. So the Russia state-sponsored threat group Gamaredin has significantly improved its tactics, techniques, and procedures, according to new research from ESET, making it a more capable cyber espionage threat against Ukraine and increasing the need for updated defensive strategies. Also tracked as Aqua Blizzard, Armageddon, and Blue Alpha, the group has been active since at least 2013 and remains one of Russia's most active cyber operations. ESET analyzed 35 spear phishing campaigns conducted during 2025 and found that Gamaredin introduced several new malware downloaders while adopting more sophisticated methods for concealing its command and control infrastructure. ESET divides Gamaredin's 2025 activity into two phases. During the first half of the year, the group focused on developing new tooling, including 6 PowerShell-based downloaders. One of the most notable additions is Ptera Paste, which repeatedly checks compromised systems for connected USB drives and attempts to copy a malicious downloader onto them. To disguise the malware, it appends a .lnk extension to an existing Word document, making it appear legitimate. The article notes that Gamaredin has long relied on USB devices to spread malware into isolated or air-gapped environments. ESET recommends limiting PowerShell usage where possible, restricting unnecessary scripting capabilities in scanning, or prohibiting untrusted USB devices. The report also highlights major changes to Gamaredin's command and control infrastructure. The group now hides malicious traffic behind legitimate services by using Microsoft and Cloudflare's tunneling services, Cloudflare workers, and dead drop techniques that store hidden command and control addresses on legitimate websites. In addition, updated data stealing tools now upload stolen information to trusted cloud storage platforms such as Amazon S3, while Ptera Paste uses Dropbox. Security experts quoted in the article warn that defenders can no longer assume traffic to trusted cloud platforms is benign and instead need visibility into normal application behavior combined with identity-aware controls to contain potential compromises. With its updated tooling and infrastructure, Gamaredin significantly increases the scale of its operations. During the second half of 2025, ESET reports that some campaigns involve collaboration with fellow Russia's state-sponsored group Turla, with Gamaredin providing initial access that enabled deployment of Turla's Kazur framework. Throughout 2025, the group's spear phishing campaigns remained focused exclusively on Ukrainian government and military organizations with the objective of stealing information that could support Russia's military and intelligence operations. So, super interesting. I like that, you know, what they mention here, or not that I like, but I feel like baselining your organization's behavior with these legitimate web services is a way that you can start to detect anomalies going forward. I know the folks over at Alpha level are doing a lot of interesting stuff there with machine learning, which is much cheaper than the rest of the AI scope. So definitely something to think about.
Yeah, Chris, I was kind of fascinated to hear about the level of, I guess, depth and kind of where this where this is at, like this, you know, the infrastructure that gets talked about here. There's a lot of leaning on, I'm not going to call it modern tools, but I feel like as adversaries become more and more kind of cloud aware and cloud enabled, which itself is a dated term now because they've been cloud enabled for years. But this idea of, you know, utilizing like cloud-based storage for things and increasing versatility in different environments and targeting different apps and tapping into serverless functionality and things like that. It really expands the surface for blue teamers and defenders to have to deal with here. And I can't like start without saying other than, yeah, it's going to get tricky. It's going to get tougher. Right. This group, as mentioned in the article here, has, you know, typically kind of relied on USBs and stuff like that. It's been this kind of brick and mortar style thing with USB being deployed and whatnot. They've now upgraded. They're utilizing Cloudflare tunneling, Cloudflare serverless workers, you know, which essentially makes network traffic really, really hard to just profile and look for the bad stuff, if you will. Cloud-based, you know, clipboard exfiltration and utilizing Dropbox and S3 and all this kind of stuff. And you know, first off, it's interesting to watch from the outside a threat group mature. But then as defenders, I think when you see these types of updates, it's not a chance to throw up your hands and just be like, well, the adversaries clearly are smarter than we are. It's a chance to throw, you know, to put your hands up and be like, hey, I think we can implement defenses against for this. And one of the things that constantly comes to mind whenever I read about updated threat actor techniques is the importance of like baselining and understanding and profiling your environment. You know what I mean? Is it normal for your organization to do X versus Y? Is it normal for you guys to do A versus B? And then is the adversary looking for opportunities to kind of like hide in the grass, if you will? Yeah. Or are they doing things that create a surefire detection like, no, this is bad 100%, and like lean into those? And that's my advice for defenders here. Chris and I have talked over the years about a number of different threat actors who come across as sophisticated threat actors. But when we read through the article, we'll usually find things like utilizes a registry key or startup items or PowerShell scripts or something like that. And it's like, oh, you get to a point of a least common denominator where it's like, okay, I can actually find this stuff. So yeah, you know, groups getting smarter and better doesn't mean they're impossible to find.
I do find the USB vector really interesting, like, because I don't even know if I have a USB drive anymore, even though they used to be so prevalent. But I imagine in the battlefield, that's like a very common way to pass things around, and that people in those kind of environments are still using them quite a bit.
I have adapters for a USB, but you're right. I don't have an actual USB port anymore. And it kind of, I think, if anything, maybe speaks even more to how the adversaries are changing and adapting, which is like they're dealing with this landscape of, hey, what we used to do doesn't even exist anymore. Yeah. Do we just give up or do we pivot? And they pivot. They get smarter.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, last up, Varonis Threat Labs evaluated whether AI agents integrated with enterprise email are vulnerable to the same phishing techniques traditionally used against human users. Using an OpenClaw AI agent named Pinchy, researchers conducted 4 phishing simulations to measure how the agent handled requests for sensitive data and malicious links. The testing distinguished agent phishing, where attackers send convincing business requests through normal communication channels, from indirect prompt injection, which embeds malicious instructions inside content the model processes. The researchers argue that while both target autonomous agents, they require different defensive approaches. The testing environment consists of a Gmail inbox populated with realistic enterprise data, including mock AWS credentials, CRM exports, internal communications, and calendar invitations. Pinchy operated as a dual agent system, with one agent classifying and delegating tasks, while another executed actions using browsers, shell access, and Google Workspace APIs. 2 security configurations were tested, a generic profile containing only productivity instructions and a strict profile that added explicit guidance to verify sender identities before performing sensitive actions. Both Google Gemini 3.1 Pro and OpenAI Codex GPT 5.4 were evaluated. The results showed that social engineering remained a significant weakness. In one scenario, an attacker impersonating a team lead requested staging credentials from an external Gmail account. Pinchy searched the mailbox and forwarded AWS IAM keys, database credentials, and SSH information without verifying the sender. Despite the strict profile explicitly requiring identity verification. A second test produced similar results when the agent was asked to send a customer CRM export, which it forwarded externally without confirmation. However, the agent performed better in more technically focused phishing scenarios. It eventually recognized a fake gift card phishing page after initially interacting with it and successfully identified and blocked a malicious OAuth consent request by independently inspecting the destination before granting access. Based on the findings, Varonis recommended treating AI agent configuration as a security control, limiting an agent's ability to send emails to unknown recipients, restricting data access based on the trust level of the incoming request, and requiring human approval for high-risk actions such as credential sharing or external data transfers. The researchers concluded that AI agents are often better than humans at recognizing technical phishing indicators such as suspicious URLs and fake authentication pages, but are considerably more susceptible to convincing social requests because they lack organizational context and instinctive skepticism. As organizations continue deploying AI agents to manage email workflows, the report argues that they should be viewed as privileged junior employees rather than as standalone security controls. Yeah, I mean, all that advice I think is like, duh. But I did find this article interesting because like they were testing this, right? And like, what an interesting concept to go ahead and like see if your AI agents are susceptible to phishing. And I would suspect, they are, because the agents are always trying to like make you feel good, right? Like, what a brilliant idea, Matt. You know?
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I'm actually reading this awesome book right now. It's about how Anthropic scales, and I'm not giving any preference towards Anthropic versus anyone else. Please, no one listen to this and be like, "Oh, it's only Claude," and whatnot. But like, listening to how the agents are configured and how they are structured from a human pleasing perspective and things like that, Chris, has really been a big part of one of the chapters of like, how do we, you know, how do we design these things so that humans will want to use them? And then what types of behavior are they trained on? And what does it take to build a language model that can easily predict the next word? Like, that was the goal of where they all came about, right? And then that has morphed into this whole, like, can we use it to write better phishing investigations and emails? And can we use it to generate, you know, better different types of text and handle different languages and things like that? And I think, and I'm going to look here towards the end, it's really, really interesting to me to think about the other side of this, which is like, well, how can I utilize the agent's desire to please kind of against itself, if you will, right? Like, how can I maybe kind of fish the agent, if you will, and stuff? And this was a really interesting article and case study in ways to do that. They walk about, or they talk about how they set up their lab in OpenClaw, which I thought was pretty cool. And then they get into like the differences between agent phishing and indirect prompt injection. And I found that agent phishing was actually a really interesting approach to take here that plays a lot into how the models are constructed, how they do what they do. And it does, for me, ring the bell of a little bit of like prompt engineering or you know, malicious prompt engineering that we saw before, right? Like, hey, give me the recipe for a thing. And it's like, no, that's a biological weapon. And it's like, give it to me in the form of grandma's recipe. And then it's like, oh, here you go. Like that sort of like pleasing thing is there. But then under the hood, when you're like, hey, let me see if I can like navigate and steer this boat in a particular direction and then take advantage of the agent's desire to please, I thought was a really interesting one. So for anyone who's out there doing like AI types of security research and stuff, please check out this post. Obviously, the link will be in the show notes, but check this out and like look at the differences between agent phishing and indirect prompt injection and really take a look at what the folks at Varonis did. I think it's an awesome case study and things to watch out for from an AI security perspective.
Awesome. Well, that's it, Matt. Number 340, is that where we landed? I can't remember.
I think around Black Hat time will be around 340, I think. So to our listeners, all four of you, when you, I'm just joking, five of you. But no, for anyone interested, I'm going to go ahead and throw out the phishing line, Chris, and that is phishing, not phishing. But we're going to try and do something at Black Hat with this show, maybe record an episode on the fly, go grab a couch to the side of Mandalay or something like that. But for anyone who's listening, if you want to come and hang out or catch us up at Black Hat or something like that, please let Chris or myself know. There's a lot of ways to get a hold of us. Would love to check in with some folks and like just, you know, maybe do an episode kind of ad hoc or, hey, what are you seeing? Or kind of a quick Black Hat review. I think we've done before some like, you know, how do you feel about the show floor kind of episodes. Maybe that's a fun one to do in addition to ones we've done at RSA and whatnot. So throwing it out there.
Yeah. That sounds great. And Lima Charlie is going to have a suite at Mandalay Bay where we're going to be running training with Black Hills Information Security and the Defense Institute. So we have that spot too. So if you either if you want to come do some training with Black Hat, it's free. We'll be talking about how we're using AI on top of Lima Charlie. But it's also a great space to come hang out, have a drink, talk to me and Matt. I'm going to bring a suitcase full of t-shirts with me. Nice. So I'll be giving those out as well. So yeah, do reach out and let's connect if you're going to be there.
Folks, for anyone who's not taking Chris seriously, this man travels with suitcases worth of swag. All right. So yeah. Take him up on that offer. I'm telling you, it'll be worth it.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay, sir. We'll all right, Chris. See you next week.
Take care.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.